I don't want no oil a spoiling my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!
Good morning, Toledo, and good afternoon, Columbus. And a big hello to Bowling Green and everyone listening on the internet, whenever and wherever you may be. I'm your friend and host, Shehbaz Khan, and I'm here with my down-to-earth co-host,
Rebecca Wood.
With me, we are going to create an unforgettable radio for this show called For a Green Future. This show, For a Green Future, is a show about ecology and environment, and we talk about those subjects in the way that affect you, your health, your wealth, and your happiness, as well as the wealth and health and happiness of your friends and families, and neighbors and pets, and the cardinals, and herons, and skunks, and bears, and pretty much everybody and everything, because we are all wrapped up together on this tiny little shiny bead of a planet called Earth. We have a very special show for you today. First, we are going to chat a bit. And today's topic, appropriately enough, is mothers and motherhood. Next, we have a very nice interview with Alex Kandeski about community gardens. Then, at the bottom of the hour, we will hear from our wonderful patrons and sponsors. After that, we turn the microphone over to our marvelous Rebecca. Rebecca, what are you going to talk about today?
Spring beauties.
Spring?
The spring beauties, they're a flower.
Wow. Very good. After that, we will have ecological news, and hopefully at some point we'll hear from you at 877-909-1007. This is a call-in and live show, and it gets better every time you call. So pick up that phone and give us a call if you want to know more about For a Green Future or about our programs. 877-909-1007. So today is Mother's Day, and we want to start out by wishing all the mothers out there a happy day. This year is especially poignant because we have learned that worldwide, the human race's fertility rate has dropped below 2.1. That's the replacement rate of population. A population needs to maintain itself. We are at 8 billion people on the planet, which is too many for the planet to maintain at the current rate that we are using up resources. Now, not every country has dropped below 2.1 yet, so our population is projected to increase until we hit about 10 billion. And again, at the rate we are using up our resources, society will most likely collapse well before we hit that point. Now, there are all kinds of guesses as to why our fertility rate has dropped so much. One of the most popular theories is to blame women. In places like Japan, where the population is shrinking by more than 500,000 a year, the popular theory is women have become too selfish to want babies. Motherhood is certainly a tremendous sacrifice.
So you're saying that having babies is in fact not in our best interest?
That's what they
in that society. Why is it not in our best interest? I think this is an important question we should ask ourselves.
We will keep on asking questions and
listeners. It should be set up so I'm so selfish. I want to have a baby because that's going to be a great situation for me. You know. That's how you get fertility rates up.
Yeah, but the theory is like women have become too selfish. They want babies. You know, they don't want babies. So we will urge our listeners to say, you know, call in and give their suggestions on 877-909-1007. So motherhood certainly is a tremendous sacrifice. Having children and raising them to be a healthy members of a society, human society, and Earth's ecosystem is one of the most difficult and challenging things a person can do, if they do it right. But blaming Japanese women for not wanting children is simply wrong. The problem is, the problem in Japan is not desire, it is fertility. There is a tremendous industry in Japan for women who want to get pregnant but can't. The Japanese are using all kinds of methods, from the most recent highest tech like in vitro fertilization to ancient folk medicine. So they are reaching out all different methods. This is where those of us who study ecology can offer another explanation. Japan is one of the most radiologically contaminated countries in the world. It's a very small country, densely populated, and has had three incidents of widespread nuclear contamination. The atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then the Fukushima nuclear disaster. We know that damage from radiation is cumulative. We also know from studies of bird populations done at Chernobyl that genetic damage and bird defects continue to increase. And that increases, keeps on increasing with each generation until after four generations, that population dies out. Most of the radioactive fallout from Fukushima went out to the sea from prevailing winds, but some of it was carried back over to the country and contaminated areas like Tokyo. We are not even one generation out from that disaster, and we are already seeing massive drops in fertility. In fact, if you look at the graph of the rate of Japan's population decline after Fukushima, the disaster in 2011, it falls from a cliff.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was catching up. The population trend was catching up. And on 2010, it was on the peak. And in 2011, the incident happened. And the population fertility rates, they just nosedived. So to support for the idea that radiation can be blamed for the drop in fertility is that Japan also has one of the oldest populations in the world. People there routinely live to be more than 100 years old. Older people are less susceptible to radiation because their cells are dividing less rapidly. Radiation kills and damages rapidly dividing cells more, because in the process of dividing, all the cells' DNA is spread out in a wide area in order to be copied. While it's in this state, an exploding radioactive atom can do maximum damage, killing or damaging it. So if there were some other kind of pollution to blame that affected all ages equally, you wouldn't expect to see as many old people either. Unfortunately, in Japan, it is illegal to research or talk about health effects of radiation from Fukushima. Wow.
But that's because it gets in women's brains and makes us super selfish. Radiation does that, evidently. Yeah, that's the only explanation. Makes sense, right? Actually, no. But, you know.
But it is political. So yes. Politically, it is much easier to blame women for not wanting to be mothers. Of course, radiation is not the only reason for the drop in fertility. Fertility is dropping all over the world. This is the year that China lost its place as the world's most populous country to India, because China's fertility rate has also declined. Accurate statistics are hard to come by in China, but the estimates are between 1.7 children per woman, far below the 2.1% needed to maintain the population. India has taken over the world's most populous country, but this year it looks like they too have dropped below the replacement rate. But they are now, India's rate is now 2.0. About half the countries in the world are still above the replacement rate. These tend to be the poorest, least developed countries like Nigeria, Angola, and Congo. These countries have highest fertility rates in the world with 6.7, 5.7, and 5.5 respectively. But even their fertility is dropping rapidly. Just 2 years ago, Nigeria's fertility rate was 6.9. Now it is 6.7. Humans are not alone in the drop of fertility rates. All across the animal kingdom, we see declining populations. Birds, insects, mammals, all are in decline. It's also pretty clear that we can't blame all of the fertility drop on the radioactive pollution. There are a host of other kinds of pollution to choose from. Microplastics, for example, now contaminate the entire world from the top of Mount Everest to our backyard. PFAS is also becoming ubiquitous. There is also growing evidence that higher temperatures mean lower fertility. Male sperms are very sensitive to heat. The hotter it is, the less motile sperms are. Sperm can actually be frozen. They can take the cold, but put them in heat and they lose all will to live and just can't make trip to fertilize the egg. It appears we have yet another thing that we can blame on global warming. So motherhood itself is under threat right now. That means we should cherish mothers all the more and thank them for being willing to make the sacrifices necessary to bring up the next generation. In many animal species, it's the mother that carries on the culture and passes on the generational wisdom. In bison, for example, it is the matriarchs, the older mothers, who know where and when to find the most nutritious grass, when and where to go to have calves, and how to avoid predators. Among predators, it is the lioness who teaches her cubs how to hunt. Often mother lions will bring their prey that is just stunned back to the cubs to teach them how to catch it. In humans, of course, it's often the mother who tells the children bedtime stories and answers their endless questions in order to help them form a coherent picture of the world. And children, they keep on asking so many questions all the time. I mean, hats off to all the mothers who you know, tirelessly they answer all the questions.
Probably he has some questions.
I have two kids, so I completely get that.
Okay.
In the environmental movement, it's the mother who are the foundation of the whole movement. Dr. Heidi Huttner, her recent film, Radioactive, The Woman of Third Three Mile Island. The woman of Three Mile Island follows the powerful story of four mothers who have fought the utility companies and the state and federal governments for decades to expose the truth about what happened with the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and expose the truth about the health consequences from the radioactive pollution it caused. In fact, over and over again, when we find citizens active in fighting an environmental problem, we find groups of concerned mothers who get together because their children and their families are being affected. Carol Mongerson at West Valley, New York, Louis Gibbs at Love Canal. Many times we hear that around the kitchen table, mothers get together, compare experiences, and find that the official story is wrong, and figure out on their own that there is some kind of pollution hurting their children, and often they are the ones who have to come up with the solutions. So one more time, we here at the For a Green Future want to say Happy Mother's Day. If you'd like to share a story about your mother teaching you some kind of ecological wisdom or giving you experiences that helped you appreciate nature, give us a call at 877-909-1007 anytime in the next hour. We would be happy to talk to you on air. Another task that has traditionally fallen to mothers in the human society is raising food. The family garden in European society was typically tended by the women. In the Native American society, it was women who raised the corns, beans, squash, and other foods that sustained the tribes. In an urban environment like Toledo or Columbus or Bowling Green, it is very, very challenging to have a garden and raise food. But we do have many community gardens, and since in this area Mother's Day has traditionally been the day that marks the start of gardening season, we thought we would interview Alex, who has been working on the community garden in Toledo for the past decade or so. Okay, Josh, let's get to that interview.
So what is your name and what is the name of your garden?
My name is Alex, Alex Konzerski. I'm non-binary and use they/them pronouns. And I work with the Collingwood Garden in the Old West End of Toledo.
Wonderful. So what is the organization of the garden? Do individual families get their own plots, or does everyone share every plot? Like it's shared commonly by everyone.
It's shared commonly by everyone. We have some spaces that we're trying to cultivate certain things, so we try to be a little bit sensitive about what gets planted around there. But otherwise, it's open to the community, and there's no kind of policing on who plants what or harvests what. It's just a shared gathering space.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Nice to see people getting together, at least for some cause.
I said absolutely.
Yeah. So I understand that during the pandemic, especially you and your organization provided a lot of people in the neighborhood with food. Is that true? And are you still providing any of those benefits?
Yeah. So there's a lot of overlap with the Collingwood Garden, the folks that help out there, and also our local Food Not Bombs chapter. The Food Not Bombs chapter uses the garden every Thursday during the warmer months on days that the weather allows. So we cook a big community meal in a kitchen in the neighborhood and then bring it down to the garden every Thursday evening for a big community meal. And we oftentimes have lots and lots of leftover produce or canned goods, lots of bread. And we put up a free pantry at the very front of our garden. And so we fill that, and that is actually kind of organically taken off in the neighborhood, and it gets filled and emptied by not just us, but neighbors, passerby, anyone that sees it and has interest in either adding something to it or taking something from it. And it's a really incredible part of our garden for sure. And we invite anyone in the community to come for those community meals on Thursday evenings.
That is very remarkable. I really appreciate it.
Wow. We love it.
So is your garden organic? Can it be considered as organic garden? If so, why? And if not, why not?
So we're not like certified organic. That's actually a very expensive process. And a lot of places just aren't able to get that kind of certification. And we don't, because we don't sell anything out of the garden, but we do use, we don't use, you know, like Roundup. We use natural like weed prevention. You know, we killed off most of the grass using just like either mulch or cardboard and bricks. You know, and we've remediated the soil all naturally with both donations and purchases of mulch. Of we have our own really big compost system that gets fed both from the plant clippings, grass clippings, as well as like you know, food leftover waste from the a bunch of the neighbors come and drop off their like home compost at our spot. So. And lots of straw, lots and lots of different, more natural methods, like the Hugel culture mounds, things of that nature to try to more naturally, you know, especially with the terrible soil we started working with. But no, we don't use, like pesticides. We don't use, like inorganic fertilizers to my knowledge. Like I said, it's pretty open and stuff, but generally speaking, it's very obvious that that's not the kind. It's not a manicured garden, by any stretch of the imagination. It's pretty wild.
So, how is the planting done around the year? Like, what are your planting plans for the year? Like, how do you plan for the planting?
A lot of it is, you know, seasonal. We try to make sure we're abiding by, you know, the recommended planting times and harvesting times for our climate zone. A lot of it is opportunistic. If we end up with a resource that just kind of pops up, then we will take advantage of that if we can. Lots of events, like community events that we'll have, like garden work days, where, you know, if it's that time of season, we'll sow, you know, either some crops or, you know, we'll be clearing out beds for later crops. It's not really super organized, but it is bountiful regardless. And it's neat to see not necessarily disorganized, but just kind of pop-up things happen that are sort of spontaneous that end up, you know, last year we got a bunch of extra seeds and ended up with a whole new bed of corn and more tomatoes and stuff like that. But we try not to spend a lot of money on it because it's a place that we would like to keep as far from capitalism as possible.
That is so cool. So we understand that community gardens can be little oases, especially in urban environment. So do you see many birds or bees or any other wildlife in those gardens, in those community gardens?
Yeah, in ours we have tons. We actually did for several years had an apiary there and had some local beekeepers would come and help tend them. But unfortunately, we think some kids were knocking over the beehives. So we kind of, at this point, at least for now, until we can figure out a better safety system for the bees, are not pursuing that. We do have little like bee homes and stuff that do provide safety and shelter for different species of bees that don't swarm and make hives. And we have a little pond, so we've had frogs. We see, you know, your usual possums and raccoons. We see tons of snakes and praying mantises and birds and bats. It is a very small plot. It's about a half an acre, and it's very close to downtown. Yeah, we've got groundhogs, what could be a fox den. I'm not sure if we have foxes that close to downtown, but yeah, every little critter that I see in our parks, I've seen in our little garden.
Wow. What a wonderful diversity in one garden. I mean, it's really appreciative. Yeah.
I love it. That's one of my favorite parts for sure.
So there are over 30,000 community gardens in the United States. According to Toledo Botanical Garden, they say they support over 125 in this region. So do these gardens interact, community gardens interact with each other, or all of them are on their own?
There is definitely some interaction for sure. There's, you know, Thomas Jackson has done a lot with the urban ag community in Toledo, and I know we share resources with him at least. The Scottwood Garden is very nearby, and we're connected with the community that tends to that one. I will say that I would love to see much, much, more robust, networking happening between us and sharing of resources and knowledge and et cetera. But we're also working on that. And a lot of the folks that are involved in the community garden are also involved in a lot of these other gardens for that reason and to, you know, for mutual aid and support.
Okay. According to the internet provides a list of benefits from community gardens, for example, like raising property values, healthier diets. And there is even a study that says women in community gardens are 46% less likely to be overweight. What do you personally get out of the gardening?
For me, it's both bridging the gap that has evolved in our culture between us and our food and us and just growing things. That's a part, you know, that's in all of our blood. That's in all of our bones. And getting back to being a part of that cycle is hugely therapeutic, both physically and mentally. And also the community bonds and social bonds that form, doing this with both friends and strangers. It's really rewarding work. The communities that I've seen grow out of those efforts have become my chosen family at this point. And as far as, you know, ecologically speaking, like seeing a very inner city garden be returned to mostly native wildlife and species of plants as opposed to lots of invasives and things that crowd out the types of plants and stuff that will, you know, restore the health of the soil and the community. Like watching that happen over the course of the last 10 years with the Collingwood Garden has been nothing short of magical. It's our little slice of utopia, you know, in the middle of the city. So I could probably go on for forever about the things that I get out of the garden. But I know we have limited time on the show, so.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate it. And thank you very much for this very informative and educative session on community gardens. I really believe that all our listeners will definitely get some benefit out of this. So before we close, would you like to add something? So, I mean, I might have forgotten to ask, and you feel that it might be important for our listeners to know. So please feel free. Okay.
I don't really think I have much to add, but just, you know, open invitation for anyone in town to come hang out with us, get your hands dirty. We have, you know, our little bonfires that are, you know, again, just building community is a huge, huge part of this. So you know, regardless of your capacity or ability, we'd love to, you know, share food and share space and time and the beauty of our garden. And yeah, if you have the chance to put a garden in closer to where you live, please do it. The more gardens, the better. And if you, you know, find a piece of land that's been abandoned and is just grass, it, you know, it doesn't take too much work to turn that into something much, much more beautiful and productive for you and the bees and your neighbors and, you know, all the other critters that we're sharing space with out here.
So one more quick question. Do you provide guidance or any kind of support, technical or otherwise, for starting a community garden? How should, you know, if anyone interested should be able to reach you? So can you tell us your contact information? Especially like for Toledo, Bowling Green, Columbus.
Absolutely. I'm not great with technology, so I don't know if it's a page or a group on Facebook, but if you check us out on Facebook, it's the Collingwood Garden. And you're like, feel free to post questions. It's a really wide network of resources and knowledge, in terms of the people in that group. Lots of, folks willing to throw down and help, if and when the availability happens, and if it's starting a garden, or if it's, trying to decide how to plan a garden, or, you know, certain techniques and methods that we've tried and have either worked or failed. Like we love sharing, anything that we've got, with folks who want to do something similar or who want to, you know, come help in our garden.
Thank you very much. So listeners, it is Collingwood Garden. Search for it on the Facebook, Collingwood Garden. Thank you so very much, Alex. Really wonderful talking to you.
And absolutely. Thank you so much for doing it.
Thank you very much once again.
So that was Alex on Community Gardens. We were very grateful for that interview. This show, For a Green Future, is also very highly grateful for our advertisers and patrons. They are the one who make this show possible. So let's hear from them now.
The Ecofill shop is located at 115 West Mary in Bowling Green, Ohio. They sell lots of different things: cosmetics, bath and body, home and garden, cleaning, towels, knickknacks, candles, fragrances, and more. They sell all of these things without plastic containers. The whole purpose of the Ecofill shop is to eliminate plastic. Customers love them. Summer says, "I'm loving the products they offer. It's sensible and affordable, all while being eco-friendly and plant-based, eliminating the unnecessary use of chemicals." That's just one of the glowing testimonials you'll see at their website, ecofillshops.com. Corinne says one of her favorite products is the dish soap. She can't believe how easy the stains come out. If you're interested, give them a call at 419-944-8862 and talk to the owner, Josie, who's very passionate about environmental issues. Or you can check out their website, ecofillshop.com. Or, best yet, you can drop in at 115 West Mary in Bowling Green. That's the Ecofill Shop. For a Green Future is also brought to you by the Wood County Park District. The Wood County Park District is a natural resources conservation agency. They protect natural spaces, maintain quality green spaces, provide engaging programming, and they teach people to love and respect nature. They also restore wildlife habitats and lead people on outdoor adventures. Wood County Parks protects natural spaces in Wood County for all to enjoy from 8 a.m. to 30 minutes past sunset every day of the year. There are several ways to get a hold of them and find out what's happening. One is to call them at 419-353-1897. Another is to visit their website, www.wcparks.org. The website again is www.wcparks.org. They are also available on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and many others. Just search for WC Parks. That's the Wood County Park District, and we're very grateful for their support.
So in addition to our sponsors, This show for a green future is also very grateful to our patrons, and we need your support more than ever. So if you want to support us, log on to patreon.com. That is patreon.com. Log on to patreon.com, choose, search for a green future on the website, and choose a monthly budget with a support system for a green future. That amount will come out from your account to our account, and we will be able to sustain and keep this show going on. So please log on to patreon.com, search for a green future, and choose a flexible monthly budget according to your willing. Let's move on with this show. Now it's time for our wonderful Rebecca. Rebecca, let's start with your wonderful topic today.
Okay, well, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about dandelions and how they feed bees.
Yeah,
one of two people, I can't remember which, I can't find the article anymore, but someone sent me an article saying that native wildflowers are in fact better if you can put native wildflowers in your yard. And luckily I remember they're better for native bees, basically, which also need help. And one of these species that was specifically mentioned was spring beauties. Spring beauties, I guess this guy likes them because he said they are in 30 states in America. So there's a spring beauty more often than not than for your area, you know. Just do a little research or ask your local botanist or something which ones are good for where you live. There are 33 species in the genus Claytonia. They're native to Asia, North America, and Central America. The leaves and tubers are edibles. They're usually a few centimeters high in the wild. They used to be in the, that's according to Wikipedia, they used to be in the purslane family. But in 2009, they moved them to Montiaceae family. You're probably somebody genetically tested them or something. Mm-hmm. It's happening a lot. Some species got shunted over to the genus Montia in 2006 also. So they're named after a guy named John Clayton, predictably enough. He was a specimen mm-hmm. collector who sent a bunch of specimens from various places back to Europe. They like the mountain chains of Asia and North America quite a bit. In the old world, they grow as far north as Kazakhstan and Mongolia and eastern Russia. And in the United States, or in the new world, they're big in U.S. and Guatemala, which is just crazy to me. You know, I don't know, my Eurocentric viewpoint doesn't usually lead me to think, oh, I bet Kazakhstan is just like America and has the same flowers, you know, but why shouldn't it? Why it's the same latitude? Why shouldn't it? You know, it's, my head's not okay. but yeah, the corm or tubers can be cooked like potatoes and taste like chestnuts, reportedly. They were consumed by Native Americans before the Europeans arrived. Like dandelions, they open and close with the sun. And they can be invasive in moist, well-drained soil. So, you know, you got to figure out what zone you're in and whether those plants actually, in fact, belong there. the seeds are sown in open containers. This is according to Fine Gardening, the last few items I've mentioned. Seeds are sown in open containers in the autumn. So you got to plant them in the... So, you know, you might say, but Becca, you should have told us this a month earlier when the dandelions and we were planting our lawn. No, you plant them in the fall. So think of it as being early, not late. They are prone to downy mildew, rust, and aphids. In gardens, according to Fine Gardening, they can grow to 6 to 12 inches high, which is a little bit higher than Wikipedia said. Maybe that's like, you know, if you get rid of all the stuff around them so they have really good conditions to grow in. They're perennials, so kind of set it and forget it. They said they're pink and white, or at least, I think they were talking about the Virginica, let's see, Claytonia Virginia, or Virginica or something. I think they're talking about a particular species. They might come in other colors, too, but pink and white are some of the most popular varieties, and they blossom in the spring. They're very rich in vitamin A and C, also. So, This is a thing to look into if you're trying to encourage the native bees.
Wow. I mean, I really admire your inquisitiveness, and you are always interesting. You know, you bring up such interesting topics every week.
I'm very interested in random stuff. I am.
So that was Rebecca, everyone. I hope you enjoyed her informative session. I think we should, Rebecca, we should move on with the ecological news now.
Okay, hit it.
So let's begin with the ecological news. Pesticide companies trying to violate local rights. The farm bill is currently under negotiation in Congress, and the pesticide manufacturers are trying to insert a provision that would violate state and local rights. They want to make it illegal for local communities to pass ordinances that would regulate, that would be regulated pesticide use. Many local communities around the country have passed bans or limitations on pesticides in order to protect their citizens from the many documented health problems that pesticides can cause, such as cancer and neurological diseases. The website Beyond Pesticides has an article published on May 8th that details this attempt, by pesticide corporations to attack democracy in America. Over 200 local communities in the US have passed some kind of limits on pesticides in order to protect pets, birds, and children from harm. Pesticides also wipe out pollinators such as bees and wasps. Eliminating pollinators can cause the entire ecosystem to collapse. Local control is the very heart of the idea of democracy. In 1991, the Supreme Court upheld the idea that local governments could regulate pesticide use. It just makes common sense that a farm field and a densely populated urban area should have different regulations on spraying chemicals. But if this provision is allowed to stand, people living in apartment complexes could be exposed to massive amounts of pesticides and have no way to stop them. Beyond Pesticides is urging people to contact their representatives in Congress opposing this provision. This reminds me of Beyond the Nuclear Organization headed by, I think, David Kemp. And he was urging the people to contact the representatives about the nuclear waste. So moving on to our next story, Cyclone Moka. A Category 5 cyclone is currently smashing into Bangladesh and Myanmar. This is another storm that rapidly intensified because of global warming. Record hot waters pumped the winds up to 150 miles per hour before the storm made the landfall. About 300,000 people were evacuated ahead of the storm. There are many refugees who live in the affected area. They are Myanmar refugees who fled to Bangladesh to escape the military dictatorship, that is the Rohingya Muslims. They have been prevented from building permanent homes and live in tents, many of which blew away before the main part of the storm even reached the coast. That is so saddening. There are reports of downed trees, blocked roads, and local flooding. We will have to wait and see how bad this devastation is. And this reminds me of Dr. Christy Phil, where she mentioned about how Bangladesh is getting flooded. And we interviewed her just a week or so ago. Listeners can go on to our YouTube channel to listen to that session once again. Now, moving on to our third story, Holtec license has been approved. We have been following the story of Holtec's attempt to create an interim storage site for nuclear wastes in New Mexico. On May 9th, the Albuquerque Journal reports that Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, has granted them permission to go ahead. As we have learned from Diana Darigo, sorry if I mispronounced it, from NIRS is...
Darigo, I think.
Darigo.
That's how you say it with your broad Midwestern accent that everybody else in the country laughs at.
Diane Darigo. She's from NIRS, and in her previous interviews, she talked about scheme of transporting nuclear waste to an interim facility would expose hundreds of millions of Americans to radiation. As the highly radioactive spent fuel rods are shipped by truck, train, and barge to New Mexico. If and when a permanent storage facility is found, the waste would again have to be transported to that site, doubling the amount of damage to the health of U.S. citizens. The state of New Mexico has passed a law banning storage of nuclear wastes without state's approval. It remains to be seen if Holtec will break this state law. Holtec is a corrupt corporation which has been convicted of bribing officials and violating numerous regulations in handling nuclear wastes. Moving on to the fourth story. Fourth story is radioactive roads in Florida. FirstCoastNews.com reports in a May 2nd story that the Florida state legislature has passed a law allowing radioactive wastes to be used in a road construction. Specifically, the wastes are a substance called phosphogypsum. This is a byproduct from the production of phosphorus fertilizer. When phosphorus fertilizer is taken from phosphate rock, what remains has high levels of uranium and the radioactive isotopes that uranium creates, such as radium. Phosphogypsum is a radioactive that the EPA bans its use for building materials and roads. Without any kind of use or disposal, the fertilizer industry has simply been piling up these radioactive wastes in huge mounds, hundreds of feet tall and hundreds of acres wide, all over the Southwest and Central Florida. Over 30 environmental groups have petitioned the government to veto the bill, saying that it would lead to contamination of waterways and threaten the health of Florida's ecosystem.
For starters, there are people who have to go out and repair those roads. You know, they got to patch them and paint them things. What they're going to do, their cancer rates are going to be through the roof in a second.
I mean, they will be on the front line of the exposure to all the workers, all the people who are working on those. Governor DeSantis has not yet decided or said which way he will go. So it's still hanging in the middle. Moving on to our next news, birds are shrinking. One thing biologists love to do is catch animals and weigh them and measure them. Looking at decades of data from these studies that captured migrating birds near Chicago and non-migrating birds in the Amazon, researchers have found that birds' bodies are shrinking at the same time their wings are getting longer. Mutation, I guess. Both of these changes are seen as adaptations to global warming. So these are adaptations to global warming. A bird with a smaller body and longer wings can get rid of excess heat more effectively. In a heat wave, the birds best able to cool themselves are more likely to survive. The study which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences also provided the scientists with a puzzle. Since it appears that smaller bird species are shrinking faster than longer ones, they tried to tie the rate of the change to factors like generation length and population size, but there was no apparent connections. So if it seems to you like birds just aren't as big as they were when you were young, apparently you are right. moving on to our
it's
next.
Not just that you were smaller, so the bird looked bigger.
Yeah, I was younger. I was smaller, so the birds were
pretty confused.
Eagle looking like a dragon.
There you go.
So moving on to our next news: wind power makes gains and saves money. Two related stories on wind power. The first comes from the United Kingdom. The Times UK reports that wind power is this year became the UK's biggest electricity source. According to a May 12 story on CNBC, wind power supplied 32.4% of the nation's electricity, easily beating natural gas, which only supplied 31.7%. Other sources in the mix included imports 12.6%, nuclear 12.5%, biomass 5.7%, solar 2.3%, hydro 1.5%, coal 1.3%. Coal consumption of coal, I mean, we can see consumption of coal is going down.
Okay.
That's a good thing. This makes the Tory government's commitment to nuclear power that much harder to justify. Wind is already supplying almost triple the amount of nuclear power at a tiny fraction of the cost. Wind generation increased by 3% while gas generation fell by 5%. So wind power is clearly already displacing carbon generation. Clearly, the UK should focus on what works and abandon nuclear. More support for focusing on the wind and solar and abandoning nuclear comes from Texas, where it turns out that wind and solar energy saved Texans about $11 billion in 2022. In a May 12 story in PV Magazine, it says that as natural gas prices surged, wind and solar wholesale prices dropped. So the savings in electricity prices from wind and solar increased by 300%, that is 300% from the previous year. The researchers who did the study concluded that if Texas continued to expand its wind and solar energy, ratepayers could save between $6 billion to $15 billion every year. However, even as this report comes out, the Republican-dominated state legislature is poised to ban future wind and solar development. It's unbelievable. Although it is saving money, and it can clearly increase the savings year on year. Moving on to our last news, that is Americans want wind and solar. For our final story, we turn to Canary Media, which on April 28 published the results of a Pew Research Center poll. It shows that 66% of Americans want the federal government to encourage wind and solar production. An additional 26% say that government should neither encourage or discourage it. Only 7% saying wind and solar should be discouraged. Only on nuclear power, 58% say government should either not encourage or actively discourage nuclear power. 36% saying neither. 22% saying discourage. That conflicts with the recent polls released by the government saying that 51% of Americans want nuclear power. So the takeaway is that the shift is finally happening. That's a good news. We need to keep it going. Wind and solar are rapidly displacing carbon and nuclear energy, even as governments try to discourage them. Iowa now gets 82% of its energy from wind and sun, 0% from nuclear. The question, of course, is, will it happen fast enough to save the planet and our society? We here at For a Green Future believe that it will, especially if mothers, our beloved mothers, continue to fight and to protect our future generations, our world, and this planet Earth. So this was our show. And before we sign off, I would like to ask Rebecca if she would like to add a few.
Well, there's this interesting thing somebody sent me, actually, about something called dog vomit mold, which is apparently encouraged by mild winters. It's not pretty. People don't like it. There's more of it. It's pretty harmless. People in other countries eat it. Just rake it back under. Don't try and get it with pesticides. It won't work.
Oh, my God. All right, my dear listeners, we all wish you a very, very happy Mother's Day from this show, For a Green Future. We hope to keep you entertained and informed. Log on to patreon.com and support us. Okay, Rebecca, we hope to see you all.
See
you next week, everybody.
Goodbye.
I don't want no oil, a spoil in my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time. No, no, no.